piece of him. He starts banging a 20-something-year-old heiress. His paintings are hot shit all of a sudden. Nobody's banging. And then, I don't know, maybe he gets greedy and thinks, hey, I've got a good thing going with this kid who's suddenly worth a fortune and who has a beautiful, a very attractive aunt and a kind of loser uncle. So I can come in like the hot shit I am and take over, get a piece of that. Scott nods, amazed. Wow, he says. What an ugly world you live in. It's called the real world. Okay. Well, there's maybe a dozen mistakes in what you just said. Do you want me to go through them in order? Or so you deny you've been sleeping with Layla Mueller. Am I having sex with her? No. She let me stay in an unused apartment. And then she took off her clothes and got in bed with you. Scott stares at Bill. How does he know that? Is it a guess? I haven't had sex with anyone in 5 years, he says. That's not what I asked. I asked if she got naked and jumped in the sack with you. Scott sighs. He has nobody to blame but himself for being in this position. I just don't understand why it matters. Answer the question. No, he says. Tell me why it matters that an adult woman is interested in me. Tell me why it's worth outing her in public for something she did when she was under her own roof that she would probably want to keep quiet. So you admit it? No. I'm saying what possible difference does it make? Does it tell us why the plane crashed? Does it help us process our grief? Or is it something you want to know because you want to know it? I'm just trying to figure out how big a liar you are. About average, I'd say, says Scott. But not about things that matter. That's part of my sobriety, a vow I took, to try and live as honestly as possible. So answer the question. No, because it's none of your business. I'm not trying to be an asshole here. I'm literally asking what possible difference it makes. And if you can convince me that my personal life after the crash has any relevance to the events leading up to the crash, and isn't just this kind of parasitical vulture exploitation, then I'll tell you everything I am. Happily. Bill studies Scott for a long moment, a bemused look on his face, and then he plays the tape. Bitch. That fucking bitch. Gus realizes he's holding his breath. The co-pilot, Charles Bush, is alone in the cockpit, and he is muttering these words under his breath. And then, louder, he says, "No," and switches off the autopilot. Charles Bush, December 31st, 1984, to August 23rd, 2015. He was somebody's nephew. That was the way people talked behind his back. As if he never would have gotten the job any other way. As if he was a bum, some kind of hack. Born in the final minutes of New Year's Eve, 1984, Charlie Bush had never been able to escape the feeling that he had missed something vital by inches. In the case of his birth, what he missed was the future. He started life as last year's news, and it never got much better. As a boy, he loved to play. He wasn't a good student. He liked math okay, but bore zero love for reading or science. Growing up in Odessa, Texas, Charlie shared the same dream as all the other boys. He wanted to be Roger Staubach, but he would have settled for Nolan Ryan. There was a pureness to high school sports, the knuckle slider and the backfield flea flicker that got into your soul. Wind sprints and alligator drills, the low-shoulder kamikaze into heavy blocking sleds, the football field where boys are hammered into men by pattern and repetition. Steve Hammond and Billy Rascal, Scab Dunaway and that big Mexican with hands the size of ribeyes. What was his name? A fly ball shagged on a cloud-free spring day. Pads and helmets shrugged on in jockstrap locker rooms, stinking of heat and the fight-or-fuck pheromones of hot teen musk. The oiled mitt between your mattress and box spring, and how you always slept better with it under there. Hard ball wrapped in a web of leather thumbs. Boys on the verge of what comes next, grappling in the dirt, using their heads to open alleys. and how it felt to run forever and never get tired. To stand in a dusty dugout, trash-talking relief pitchers, your buddy Chris Hardwick lowing like a cow. The coffin corner and the crackback block. The primal monkey joy of picking dirt from your cleats with any old stick. A bunch of boys on a bench spitting sunflower shells and digging deep down in the rubber. The in-between hop and the lefty switch. Hope. Always hope. And how, when you're young, every game you play feels like the reason the world exists. The pick-off and the squeeze play. And the heat. Always the heat, like a knee in your back, a boot on your neck. Drinking Gatorade by the gallon and chewing ice chips like a mental patient, bent at the knee, sucking wind in the midday sun. The feel of a perfect spiral as it reaches your hands. Boys in shower stalls laughing at each other's dicks, bell-curving the cheerleaders and pissing on the next guy's feet. The bean ball and the brushback. And how it feels to round first base and dig for second, eyes on the center fielder, sliding, head first, already safe in your mind. The panic of getting caught in a pickle, and how white chalk lines, when they're fresh, gleam like lightning against the grass, itself a deep, impossible green. Heaven is that color. And the bright lights of Friday night, those perfect alabaster lights, and the roar of the crowd. The simplicity of the game. Always forward, never back. You throw the ball, you hit the ball, you catch the ball. And how after graduation, nothing would ever be that simple again. He was somebody's nephew. Uncle Logan, his mother's brother, Logan Birch, a 6-term U.S. senator from the great state of Texas, friend to oil and cattle, longtime chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. Charlie knew him mostly as a rye drinker with sculpted hair. Uncle Logan was the reason Charlie's mother pulled out the fancy plates. Every Christmas, they drove out to his mansion in Dallas. Charlie remembered the family all dressed in matching Christmas sweaters. Uncle Logan would tell Charlie to make a muscle, then squeeze his arm hard. "Gotta toughen this boy up," he told Charlie's mother. Charlie's father had died a few years earlier when Charlie was 6. Coming home from work one night, an 18-wheeler sideswiped him. His car flipped 6 times. They had a closed casket funeral and buried Charlie's father in the nice cemetery. Uncle Logan paid for everything. Even in high school, being Logan Birch's nephew helped him. He played right field for the varsity team, even though he couldn't hit as well as the other boys, couldn't steal a base to save his life. It was unspoken, this special treatment. In fact, for the first 13 years of his life, Charlie had no idea he was being elevated above his station. He thought the coaches liked his hustle. But that changed in high school. It was the locker room that woke him up to this conspiracy of nepotism, the wolf-pack mentality of boys in jockstraps surrounding him in the shower. Sports is a meritocracy, after all. You start because you can hit, because you can run and throw and catch. In Odessa, the football team was notorious for its speed and precision. Every year, veterans of the baseball team got a free ride to good colleges. West Texas sports were competitive. You put up lawn signs. Businesses closed early on game days. People took this shit seriously. And so a player like Charlie, mediocre in all things, stood out like a sore thumb. The first time they came for him, he was 15. A skinny freshman who'd scored the starting kicker spot after shanking a 36-yard field goal. 6 hulking ranch thugs, stripped down and sweaty, shoved him into a shower stall. "Watch your shit," they told him. Cowering in the corner, Charlie could smell their sweat, the musky funk of half a dozen teenage linebackers, not one under 250 pounds, who'd just spent 3 hours steam-cooking in the August sun. He bent and vomited onto their feet. They beat him good for that, slapping him around with their cocks for good measure. In the end, huddled on the floor, he flinched when LaVon Davies bent and hissed in his ear, "Tell a fucking soul and you're dead." It was Uncle Logan who pulled the strings to get Charlie into the flight training program of the National Guard. It turned out he wasn't a bad pilot, though he tended to freeze in sudden emergencies. And after the National Guard, when Charlie was kicking around Texas, unable to hold down a job, it was Logan who spoke to a friend at Gull Wing and landed Charlie an interview. And though he had yet to find anything in life he was truly good at, Charlie Bush did have a certain sparkle in his eye and a certain cowboy swagger that worked with the ladies. He could charm a room, and he looked good in a suit. And so, when he sat down with the HR director of the airline, he seemed like the perfect addition to Gull Wing's fast-growing stable of young, attractive flight personnel. They started him as a co-pilot. This was September 2013. He loved the luxury jets, loved the clients he served, billionaires and heads of state. It made him feel important. But what he really loved was the grade-A top-shelf pussy working the main cabin. God damn, he thought, the first time he saw the flight crew he'd be working with. Four beauties from around the world, each more fuckable than the next. "Ladies," he said, lowering his aviators and giving them his best Texas grin. The girls didn't even blink. Turns out they didn't sleep with co-pilots. Sure, the company had a policy, but it was more than that. These women were international sophisticates. Many spoke five languages. They were angels that mortal men could look at, but never touch. Flight after flight, Charlie made his play, and flight after flight, he was rebuffed. Turns out not even his uncle could get him into the pants of a Gull Wing flight attendant. He had been at the company for 8 months when he met Emma. Right away he could tell she was different from the others, more down to earth. And she had that slight gap between her front teeth. Sometimes during a flight, he'd catch her in the galley humming to herself. She would blush when she realized he was standing there. She wasn't the hottest girl in the fleet, he thought, but she seemed attainable. He was a lion stalking a herd of antelope, waiting for the weakest one to wander off. Emma told him her father had flown for the Air Force, so Charlie inflated his experience in the National Guard, telling her he spent a year in Iraq flying F-16s. He could tell she was a daddy's girl. Charlie was 29 years old. His own father had died when he was 6. The only real role model he'd had for how to be a man was a rye drinker with fancy hair who told Charlie to make a muscle every time they met. He knew he wasn't as smart as the other guys or as skilled. But being less talented meant he'd had to develop ways of passing. You didn't have to be confident, he realized early on. You just had to seem confident. He was never a great fastball hitter, so he learned how to get on base by walking. He couldn't deliver the monster punt, so he mastered the onside kick. In classroom situations, he'd learned to deflect hard questions by making a joke. He learned how to talk shit on the baseball field and how to swagger in the National Guard. Wearing the uniform made you a player, he reasoned, just like carrying a weapon made you a soldier. It may have been nepotism that got him in, but there was no denying now that his resume was real. And yet, who had ever really loved Charles Nathaniel Bush for who he was? He was somebody's nephew, a pretender, the varsity athlete who'd become a pilot. It looked, for all intents and purposes, like an American success story, so that's what he called it. But deep down inside, he knew the truth. He was a fraud. And knowing this made him bitter. It made him mean. He caught a ride from Heathrow on a Gull Wing charter, landing in New York at 3 p.m. on Sunday, August 23rd. It had been 6 months since Emma broke up with him, since she told him to stop calling her, stop going by her place and trying to get on her flights. She was scheduled to do a milk run to Martha's Vineyard and back, and Charlie had it in his head that if he could just get a few minutes alone with her, he could make her understand how much he loved her, how much he needed her, and how sorry he was about what had happened. Everything, basically. The way he'd treated her. The things he'd said. If he could just explain. If she could only see that deep down he wasn't a bad guy. Not really. He was just someone who'd been faking his way through the world for so long he had become consumed by the fear of being found out. And all of it, the cockiness, the jealousy, the pettiness, was a byproduct of that. You try pretending to be someone you're not for 20 years, see how it changes you. But my God, he He didn't want to be afraid anymore. Not with Emma. He wanted her to see him, the real him, to know him. Because didn't he deserve that for once in his life? To be loved for who he was, not who he pretended to be? He thought about London, seeing Emma again, like a snake bite, poison, spreading through his veins, and how his instinct when he felt out of his depth was to attack, close the distance between himself and his, what, opponent? Prey? He didn't know. It was just a feeling, a kind of panicked advance that had him put on airs, had him hike up his pants and slip on his best cowboy swagger. The only thing you can do, he had long ago decided, when you care too much, is to act like you could give two shits about school, about work, about love. It had worked often enough that the behavior had calcified inside of him. And so when he saw Emma, when his heart jumped into his throat and he felt vulnerable and exposed, this is what he did. Turned up his nose, insulted her weight, then spent the rest of the night following her around like a puppy. Peter Gaston had been happy to give Charlie the vineyard flight, get a couple more days of R&R in London. They'd bonded Friday night, drinking until dawn in Soho, bouncing from bar to nightclub, vodka, rum, ecstasy, a little coke. Their next scheduled drug test wasn't for 2 weeks, and Peter knew a guy who could get them clean piss, so they threw caution to the wind. Charlie was trying to get his courage up. Every time he looked at Emma, he felt like his heart was splitting in two. She was so beautiful, so sweet, and he'd fucked it up so royally. Why had he said that to her before, about putting on a few pounds? Why did he have to be such an asshole all the time? When she came out of the bathroom in a towel, all he'd wanted to do was hold her, to kiss her eyelids the way she used to kiss his, to feel the pulse of her against him, to breathe her in. But instead, he made some bullshit wisecrack. He thought about the look on her face that night when he put his hands around her throat and squeezed. How the initial thrill of sexual experimentation turned first to shock, then horror. Did he really think she would like it? That she was that kind of girl? He had met them before. The tattooed kamikazes who liked to be punished for who they were, who liked the scrapes and bruises of reckless animal collision. But Emma wasn't like that. You could see it in her eyes, the way she carried herself. She was normal, a civilian, unblemished by the trench warfare of a fucked-up childhood, which was what made her such a good choice for him, such a healthy move. She was the Madonna, not the whore. A woman he could marry. A woman who could save him. So why had he done it? Why had he choked her? Except maybe to bring her down to his level. To let her know that the world she lived in wasn't the safe, gilded theme park she thought it was. He'd had some dark times after that night, after she left him and stopped answering his calls. Days he lay in bed from sunrise to sundown, filled with dread and loathing. He kept it together at work, riding the second chair through takeoffs and landings. Years of covering his weaknesses had taught him to pass, no matter how he felt inside. But there was an animal attraction inside him on those flights, a live wire sparking in his heart that wanted him to push the yoke nose down, to roll the plane into oblivion. Sometimes it got so bad he had to fake a shit and hide out in the washroom, breathing through the blackness. Emma, like a unicorn, the mythic key to happiness. He sat in that bar in London and watched her eyes, the corner of her mouth. He could feel her deliberately not looking at him, could feel the muscles in her back tensing whenever his voice got too loud at the bar, trading jokes with Gaston. She hated him, he thought. But isn't hate just the thing we do to love when the pain becomes unbearable? He could fix that, he thought, turn it back, explain the hate away with the right words, the right feelings. He would have one more drink, and then he would go over. He would take her hand softly and ask her to come outside for a cigarette, and they would talk. He could see every word in his head, every move, how first it would be just him, how he would lay it all out, the history of Charlie, and how she would have her arms folded across her chest in the beginning, defensive. But as he went deeper, as he told her about his father's death, being raised by a single mom, and how somehow he ended up a ward of his uncle, how, unbeknownst to him, his uncle paved the way for Charlie to coast through life, but how it was never what he wanted. How all Charlie wanted was to be judged on his own merits, but how, as time went on, he got scared that his best wasn't good enough. So he surrendered and let it happen. But that was all over now, because Charlie Bush was ready to be his own man, and he wanted Emma to be his woman. And as he talked, she would lower her arms. She would move closer, and in the end, she would hold him tight, and they would kiss. He had another 7-7, a beer back. And then, at some point, when he was in the bathroom with Peter doing another line, Emma disappeared. He came out of the john wiping his nose, and she was gone. Charlie made a beeline for the other girls, feeling jittery and spooked. "Hey," he said. "So Emma, did she split?" The girls laughed at him. They looked at him with their fucking haughty model eyes and barked their disdain.
"Sweetie," said Chelsea, "do you really think you're in the same league?
Just fucking is she gone?"
"Whatever. She said she was tired. She went back to the flat."
Charlie threw some cash on the bar, ran out onto the street. The booze and the drugs had him feeling turned around, which was why he walked 10 blocks in the wrong direction before finally figuring it out. Fuck! Fuck! And by the time he got back to the apartment, she was gone. Her stuff was gone. She had vanished. And the next day, when Peter groaned and said he had to get to New York for a job and that Emma would be on it, Charlie offered to take the gig. He lied and told Peter he would clear it with the company, but it wasn't until he showed up at Teterboro Airport in New Jersey that anyone knew that Charlie was taking Peter's place, and at that point, it was too late to do anything. Riding a jump seat in the cockpit of a 737 across the Atlantic, Charlie drank coffee after coffee, trying to sober up, to get his shit together. He'd startled Emma, showing up like that in London. He could see that now. He wanted to apologize, but she'd changed her phone number, had stopped responding to his emails. So what choice did he have? How else could he fix this except to track her down once more, to plead his case, throw himself on her mercy? Teterboro was a private airport 12 miles outside Manhattan. Gullwing kept a hangar there, its corporate logo, two hands crossed at the thumb, fingers spread like wings, was emblazoned in gray on the flat tan siding. The hangar office was closed on Sunday, except for a skeleton crew. Charlie took a cab from JFK, bypassing the city to the north and coming in on the George Washington Bridge. He tried not to look at the meter as the fare rose. He had a platinum Amex card, and besides, he told himself it didn't matter what it cost. This was for love. Peter had given him the flight's itinerary. Scheduled time of departure from New Jersey was 7 p.m. The plane was an Osprey 700 SL. They'd take the short hop to the vineyard, sans passengers, board their charter, and head right back. They wouldn't even need to refuel. Charlie figured that gave him at least 5 hours to find a private moment with Emma, to pull her aside and touch her cheek and talk the way they used to take her hand and say, "I am so sorry," to say, "I love you. I know that now. I was an idiot. Please forgive me." And she would, because how could she not? What they'd had was special. The first time they'd made love, she'd cried, for God's sake, cried at the beauty of it. And he'd fucked it up. But it wasn't too late. Charlie had seen all the romantic comedies these chicks swooned over. He knew that perseverance was the key. Emma was testing him. That was all. Putting him through his paces. It was female 101. She loved him, but he needed to prove himself, to show her he could be steady, reliable, to show her that this time it was storybook. She was the fairy princess, and he was the knight on the horse. And he would. He was hers, now and forever, and he would never give up. And when she saw that, she would fall into his arms, and they'd be together again. He showed his pilot's license at the Teterboro security gate. The guard waved them in. Charlie felt the nerves in his stomach, rubbed his face with his hand. He wished he'd remembered to shave, worried that he looked sallow, tired. "It's the White Hangar," he told the cabbie.
266, the guy told him after they came to a stop.
Charlie ran his card, climbed out, taking his silver roller bag. The Osprey was parked on the tarmac just outside the hangar. Floodlights from the building made the fuselage glow. He never got tired of the sight, a precision aircraft like a gleaming thoroughbred, all thrust and lift under the hood, but smooth as butter on the inside. A 3-member ground crew was gassing her up, a catering truck parked near the nose. 104 years ago, 2 brothers built the first airplane and flew it on a North Carolina beach. Now there were fleets of fighters, hundreds of commercial airliners, cargo planes, and private jets. Flying had become routine, but not for Charlie. He still loved the feeling as the wheels left the ground, as the plane surged into the stratosphere. But that didn't surprise him. He was a romantic, after all. Charlie scanned the area for Emma, but didn't see her. He had changed into his pilot's uniform in the bathroom at JFK. Seeing himself in the crisp whites steadied him. Who was he, if not Richard Gere, in An Officer and a Gentleman? Wearing it now, he wheeled his roller bag into the hangar, heels clicking on the asphalt. His heart was in his throat, and he was sweating like he was back in fucking high school, angling to ask Cindy Becker to prom. Jesus, he thought. What is this chick doing to you? Pull it together, Bush. He felt a flash of anger, the rage of an animal against its cage, but he ignored it. Squelch that shit, Bush told himself. Stay on mission. Then he spotted Emma in the second floor office. His heart rate multiplied. He dropped his bag and hurried up the stairs. The office was a catwalk overlook built into the hangar. Staff only. Clients never even entered the hangar. They were ferried directly to the plane by limousine. It was the strict written policy of the company that employees keep the behind-the-scenes process of Gullwing Air invisible. Nothing that would burst the bubble of the traveler's luxury experience. To reach the office, you had to climb an exterior flight of metal stairs. Putting a hand on the grip railing, Charlie felt his mouth go dry. On impulse, he reached up and adjusted his hat, giving it a slight cock. Should he put on the aviators? No, this was about connection, about eye contact. His hands felt like wild animals, fingers twitching, so he shoved them in his pockets, focusing on each stair, on lifting his feet and putting them down. He had thought about this moment for the last 16 hours, seeing Emma, how he would smile warmly and show her he could be calm, gentle. And yet he felt anything but calm. It had been 3 days since he'd slept more than 2 hours straight. Cocaine and vodka were what was keeping him smooth, keeping him moving. He went over it again in his head. He would reach the landing, open the door. Emma would turn and see him, and he would stop and stand very still. He would open himself to her, show her with his body and his eyes that he was here, that he'd gotten her message. He was here, and he wasn't going anywhere. Except it didn't happen that way. Instead, as he reached the landing, he found Emma was already looking his way, and when she saw him, she went white. Her face. And her eyes went giant, like saucers. Worse, when he saw her see him, he froze, literally, with his right foot hovering in midair, and gave a little wave. A wave? Like what kind of idiot gives a faggy little wave to the girl of his dreams? And in that moment, she turned and fled deeper into the office. Fuck, he thought. Fuckity fuck fuck! He exhaled and finished climbing. Stanhope was in the office, the coordinator who'd be working tonight. She was an older woman with zero lips, just an angry slash under her nose.
I'm here to work 613, he said. Checking in.
You're not Gaston, she said, looking at her logbook.
Stellar fucking observation, he told her, eyes searching the inner offices, visible through the glass wall, for Emma.
Excuse me?
Nothing. Sorry, I just... Gaston is sick. He called me.
Well, he should have called me. We can't just have personnel swapping shifts. It screws up the whole...
Absolutely. I'm just doing the guy up. Did you see where Emma... He peered through the glass, looking for his dream girl, feeling a little frantic. His mind was racing, auditioning scenarios, working double time to figure out how to rectify this whole disaster.
She ran, he thought. She fucking turned tail and... What the hell was that about?
Charlie looked at the desk troll, gave his best smile.
What's your name?
Jenny, he said. I'm sorry, but we... It's almost liftoff time. Can we figure out the paperwork when we come back? The woman nodded.
Okay, we'll deal with this after the flight.
Charlie turned away. She called after him.
Check in with me when you land, though. We have these protocols for a reason.
Yeah, said Charlie. Sure. Sorry for the... I don't know why Gaston didn't call. He stumbled back to the plane, casting around for Emma. He climbed the steps and was surprised to find her in the galley breaking up ice. Hey, he said. Where did you... I was looking for you. She turned on him.
Why are you even... I don't want you here. I don't...
He reached out to hug her, hold her, to show her how love would fix everything. But she reared back, hate in her eyes, and slapped him hard across the face. Cheeks stinging, he stared at her. It was as if the sun had, in the course of an otherwise normal day, suddenly exploded in the sky. She held his eye defiantly, then looked away, afraid suddenly. Charlie watched her walk off, then turn dully, his mind a perfect blank, and entered the cabin, where he almost ran into Melody, the captain on the flight. James, older guy, not much fun, but competent. Extremely. British Ponce thought he was the boss of everything, but Charlie knew how to kowtow. It was part of passing. Afternoon, Captain, he said. Melody recognized him, frowned. What happened to Gaston? He asked. You got me, said Charlie. Stomach thing, I think. All I know is I got a call. The captain shrugged. It was the front office's problem. They chatted some more, but Charlie wasn't really paying attention. He was thinking about Emma. What she'd said. What he could have done differently. Passion. That's what they had, he told himself suddenly. Fire. The thought cheered him, the buzz in his cheek fading. Powering up the system and running diagnostics, Charlie told himself that he'd handled things, well, maybe not perfectly, but she was just playing hard to get. The next 6 hours would go like fucking clockwork. Textbook takeoff, textbook landing. There and back in 5 hours, and then he'd be the one changing his phone number, and when she came to her senses and realized what she'd lost, well, she'd be the one begging him for forgiveness. Cycling the engines, he heard the cockpit door open. Emma stormed into the main cabin.
Keep him away from me, she told Melody, pointing at Charlie,
then stalked back to the galley. The captain looked over at his co-pilot. You got me, said Charlie. Must be her time of the month. They finished their pre-flight run-through and closed the hatch. At 6:59 p.m., they taxied to the runway and lifted off without incident, moving away from the setting sun. A few minutes later, Captain Melody banked to starboard and pointed them toward the coast. For the rest of the flight to Martha's Vineyard, Charlie stared out at the ocean, slumping visibly in his seat. As the rage left him, the serious lightning nerves that had been fueling him, he felt exhausted, deflated. The truth was, he hadn't slept really in maybe 36 hours. A few minutes on the flight from London, but mostly he'd been too amped up, a lingering effect of the coke, possibly, or the vodka Red Bulls he'd been drinking. Whatever it was, now that his mission had failed, had epically imploded, he felt destroyed. 15 minutes from the vineyard, the captain stood,
put a hand on Charlie's shoulder. Charlie jumped in his seat, startled.
"She's all yours," said Melody. "I'm going to grab a coffee."
Charlie nodded, straightening. The plane was on autopilot, gliding effortlessly over the open blue. As the captain exited the cockpit, he closed the door, which had been open, behind him. It took Charlie a few moments to register that the captain had closed the door. And why? Why would he do that? It had been open for takeoff, why close it now? Except for privacy. Charlie felt a hot flush go through him. That was it. Melody wanted privacy so he could talk to Emma.
About me.
A new burst of adrenaline hit Charlie's bloodstream. He needed to focus. He slapped himself in the face a couple of times.
What should I do?
He ran through his options. His first instinct was to storm out and confront them, to tell the pilot that this shit was none of his business. Go back to your seat, old man. But that was non-rational. He could be fired for that, probably. No, he should do nothing. He was a professional. She was the drama queen, the one who brought their private business into work. He would fly the plane, okay, watch the autopilot fly the plane, and be the grounded adult. And yet he had to admit that it was killing him. The closed door. Not knowing what was going on out there. What she was saying. Against his better judgment, he stood, then sat, then stood again. Just as he was reaching for the door, it opened, and the captain came back with his coffee. "Everything okay?" he asked, closing the door behind him. Charlie turned at the waist and did a kind of upper body stretch. "Absolutely," he said. "Just got a cramp in my side, trying to stretch it out." The sun was starting to set as they made their final approach into Martha's Vineyard. On the ground, Melody taxied past ground control and parked. Charlie stood as soon as the engines were off.
"Where are you going?" the captain asked.
"Cigarette," said Charlie. The captain stood. "Later," he said. "I want you to run a full diagnostic on the flight controls." The stick felt tight on landing.
"Just a quick cigarette?" Charlie said. "We've got, like, an hour before takeoff."
The captain opened the cockpit door. Behind him, Charlie could see Emma in the galley. Sensing the cockpit door open, she looked over, saw Charlie, and looked away fast. The captain shifted his hip to block Charlie's view. "Run the diagnostic," he said, and exited, closing the door behind him.
"Fucking petty bullshit,"
thought Charlie, turning to the computer. He sighed once, twice. He stood. He sat. He rubbed his hands together until they felt hot, then pressed them against his eyes. He'd flown the plane for 15 minutes before landing. The stick felt fine. But Charlie was a professional, Mr. Professional, so he did what he was asked. That had always been his strategy. When you spend your life playing a role, you learn how to make it look good. File your paperwork on time. Be the first on the field for grass sprints. Keep the uniform pressed and clean, your hair trimmed, your face shaved. Stand up straight. Be the part. To calm himself, he pulled out his headphones and put on some Jack Johnson. Melody wanted him to run diagnostics? Fine. He wouldn't just do what he was asked. He would spit polish this thing. He started in on the diagnostic, soft guitars strumming in his ears. Outside, the last sliver of sun dipped behind the trees, and the sky took on a midnight hue. The captain found Charlie in his seat 30 minutes later, fast asleep. He shook his head and dropped into his chair. Charlie shot up, heart jackhammering, disoriented.
"What?"
he said.
"Did you run the diagnostic?" Melody asked.
Yeah, said Charlie, flicking switches.
Everything looks good."
The captain looked at him for a beat, then nodded.
"Okay, the first client is here. I want to be ready for wheels up at 2200 hours.
"Sure," said Charlie, gesturing. I gotta piss." The captain nodded. "Come right back." Charlie nodded.
"Yes, sir,"
he said, managing to keep all but a hint of sarcasm out of his voice. He stepped out of the cockpit. The crew bathroom was right next to the cockpit.
He could see Emma standing in the open doorway, waiting to greet the first guests as they arrived. Charlie could see on the tarmac what looked like a family of five, illuminated in the headlights of a Range Rover. He studied the back of Emma's neck. Her hair was up in a bun, and there was a loose wisp of auburn arced across her jaw. The sight of it made him dizzy. The overwhelming urge he had to fall to his knees and press his face into her lap, an act of penance and devotion, the gesture of a lover, but also that of a son to a mother. For what he wanted was not the sensual pleasure of her naked flesh, but the maternal feeling of her hands on his head, the unconditional acceptance, the feel of her fingers in his hair, the motherly stroking. It had been so long since anyone had just stroked his hair, had rubbed his back until he fell asleep. And he was so tired, so profoundly tired. In the bathroom, he stared at himself in the mirror. His eyes were bloodshot, his cheeks dark with stubble. This was not who he wanted to be. A loser. How had he let himself fall this far? How did he ever let this girl break him down? When they were dating, he found her affection stifling, the way she would hold his hand in public, the way she put her head on his shoulder, as if she were marking him. She was so into him, he felt it had to be an act. As a lifelong role player, he was certain he could spot another bullshitter from a mile away. So he went cold on her. He pushed her away to see if she would come back. And she did. It made him mad. "I'm on to you," he thought. "I know you're fucking faking. The con is up, so drop the act." But she just seemed hurt, confused. And finally, one night when he was fucking her and she reached up and stroked his cheek and said, "I love you," something inside him snapped. He grabbed her by the throat, at first just to shut her up, but then seeing the fear in her eyes, the way her face turned red, he found himself squeezing harder, and his orgasm was like a white bolt of lightning from his balls to his brain. Now, staring at himself in the mirror, he tells himself he was right all along. She was faking. She had been playing him, and now that she was done, she'd just thrown him away. He washes his face, dries his hands on a towel. The plane is vibrating as passengers climb the stairs. He can hear voices, the sound of laughter. He runs his hands through his hair, straightens his tie. Professional, he thinks. And then, just before he opens the door and re-enters the cockpit, bitch. Flight. Gus hears an automated voice on the tape. "Autopilot disengaged." This is it, he thinks. The beginning of the end. He hears the sound of the engines, an increase in RPM that he knows from the data recorder was the co-pilot putting the plane into a turn and powering up. "You like that?" he hears Bush mutter. "Is that what you want?" It's just a matter of time now. The plane will impact the water in less than 2 minutes. And now he hears pounding on the door, and hears Melody's voice.
"Jesus, let me in! Let me in! What's going on? Let me in!"
But now the co-pilot is silent. Whatever thoughts he has in the last moments of his life, he keeps to himself. All that remains under the sound of the pilot's desperation are the sounds of a plane spiraling to its death. Gus reaches over and turns up the volume, straining to hear something, anything. Because it's a digital signal, there is no tape hiss, just the silence of the cockpit, peppered with low mechanical noise and the thrum of the jets. And then, gunshots. He jumps, swerving the car into the left-hand lane. Around him, car horns blare. Swearing, he corrects back into his own lane, losing count of the number of shots in the process. At least six, each like a cannon on the otherwise silent tape. And under them, the sound of a whispered mantra.
Shit, 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 shit.
Bang, 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 bang. And now a surge in RPMs as Bush leans on the throttle, the plane spinning like a leaf circling down a drain. And even though he knows the outcome, Gus finds himself praying that the captain and the Israeli security man will get the door open, that they'll overcome Bush and the captain will take his seat and find some miracle solution to right the plane. And, as if in sympathy with his own held breath, the gunshots are replaced by the sound of a body slamming into the metal cockpit door. Later, technicians will recreate the sounds, determining which is a shoulder and which is a kick. But for now, they are just the urgent sounds of survival. Please, 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 thinks Gus, even as the rational part of his brain knows they're doomed. And then, in the split second before the crash, a single syllable. Oh. Then, impact. A cacophony of such size and finality that Gus closes his eyes. It continues for 4 seconds. Primary and secondary impacts, the sounds of the wing shearing off, the fuselage breaking up. Bush will have been killed immediately. The others may have lasted a second or two, killed not by the impact, but by flying debris. None, thankfully, lived long enough to drown as the plane sank to the bottom. This they know from the autopsies. And yet somewhere in the chaos, a man and a boy survived. Hearing the crash on tape turns the fact of this into a full-blown miracle. Boss? Comes Mayberry's voice.
Yeah.
He did it. It was about the girl. The flight attendant. Gus doesn't respond. He is trying to comprehend the tragedy. To kill all those people, a child. For what? A lunatic's broken heart?
I want a full analysis of all the mechanics, he says. Every sound.
Yes, sir.
I'll be there in 20 minutes.
Gus hangs up. He wonders how many more years he can do this job, how many more tragedies he can stomach. He is an engineer who is beginning to believe that the world is fundamentally broken. He sees his exit approaching, moves to the right lane. Life is a series of decisions and reactions. It is the things you do and the things that are done to you. And then it's over. The first voice Scott hears on the tape is his. What's going on? He asks. In your mind. With us. The recording quality is distant, a layer of mechanical hiss over the top. It sounds like a phone call, which is what Scott realizes it is in the instant he recognizes his own voice. Let's go to Greece, he hears Layla say. There's a little house on a cliff I own through, like, 6 shell companies. Nobody knows a thing. Complete mystery. We could lie in the sun and eat oysters, dance after dark. Wait till the dust clears. I know I should be coy with you, but I've never met anyone whose attention is harder to get. Even when we're together, it's like we're in the same place, but different years. Where did you... Scott asks. Bill looks at him and raises his eyebrows with a kind of triumph.
You still think we should believe nothing happened?
Scott stares at him. How did you... Bill holds up a finger. Wait for it. The tape plays again. How's the boy? It's Gus's voice. Scott doesn't have to hear the next voice to know that it will be his. He's not talking, really, but he seems to like that I'm here. So maybe that's therapeutic. Eleanor's really strong.
And the husband?
He left this morning with luggage. A long pause.
I don't have to tell you how that's going to look, says Gus.
Scott finds himself mouthing his next words along with the tape. Since when does how a thing looks matter more than what it is?
2012, I think, says Gus. Especially after your hideout in the city. How that made the news. The heiress, which I said find some place to hide, not shack up in a tabloid story. Nothing happened. I mean, yeah, she took off her clothes and climbed into bed with me, but I didn't... We're not talking about what did or didn't happen, says Gus. We're talking about what it looks like.
The tape ends. Bill sits forward.
So you see, he says, lies. From the very beginning, you've been telling nothing but lies.
Scott nods, his mind putting the piece together.
You recorded us, he says.
Eleanor's phone. That's how you knew. When I called her from Layla's house, that's how you knew where I was.
He traced the call.
And then, did you have Gus's phone, too? The FBI? Is that how...
All those leaks, is that how you got the memo?
Scott can see Bill's producer waving frantically from off-camera. She looks panicked.
Scott leans forward.
You bugged their phones. A plane crashed. People died. And you bugged the phones of the victims. Their relatives.
People have a right to know, says Bill. This was a great man, David Bateman, a giant. We deserve the truth.
Yeah, but do you know how illegal it is, what you did? Not to mention, immoral.
And we're sitting here, and you're worried about what? That I had a consensual relationship with a woman?
Scott leans forward.
And meanwhile, you have no idea what actually happened. How the co-pilot locked the captain out of the cockpit. How he switched off the autopilot and put the plane into a dive. How 6 shots were fired into the door, gunshots, probably by the Bateman security guard, trying to get it open, trying to regain control of the plane, but they couldn't, so they all died.
He looks at Bill, who, for once in his life, is speechless.
People died. People with families. With children. They were murdered, and you're sitting here asking me about my sex life? Shame on you.
Bill gets to his feet. He looms over Scott.
Scott stands himself, facing off, unflinching.
Shame on you, he repeats, this time quietly, just to Bill.
For a minute, it seems Bill will hit him. His fists are balled. And then 2 cameramen are grabbing him, and Krista is there.
Bill, she yells. Bill, calm down.
Get off me, yells Bill, struggling. But they hold him firm.
Scott stands. He turns to Krista.
Okay, he says. I'm done.
He walks away, allowing the anger and struggle behind him to fade. He finds a hallway and follows it to an elevator. Feeling like a man waking from a dream, he presses the button, then waits for the doors to open. He thinks about the floating wing and how it was on fire. Thinks about the boy's voice calling in the dark. He thinks about his sister and how he waited on his bike in the growing darkness. He thinks about every drink he ever took and what it feels like to hear the starting gun and dive into chlorinated blue. Somewhere the boy is waiting, playing trucks in the driveway, coloring outside the lines. There is a lazy river and the sound of the leaves blowing in the wind. He will get his paintings back. He will reschedule those gallery meetings and any others that present themselves. He will find a pool and teach the boy to swim. He has waited long enough. It's time to press play, to let the game finish. See what happens. And if it's going to be a disaster, then that's what it's going to be. He has survived worse. He is a survivor. It's time he started acting like one. And then the doors open, and he gets on.
This has been a Hachette audio production of Before the Fall, written by Noah Hawley, read by Robert Petkoff, produced and directed by Cheryl Smith, recorded by Tommy Herron, post-production by A1 Sound. Before the Fall is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2016 by Noah Hawley. Audio production copyright 2016, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.